All right, a few announcements. Just to remind you that December 24th and 25th there is no class, and December 31st and January 1st there will be no class. We will have class on December 29th, which is Sunday only. So this time of year you get several weeks off. it's time to set up schedule. As I've said, I would exhort everybody here to take your turn to apply towards the body and get with Bill. He handles all that. Take a month. Each person or group, whoever does, takes a particular month, and then you have to be here early to set up on Sunday. And you don't have to worry about breaking down on Wednesday. You usually have plenty of help then, so that's not that big of a deal. And lastly, Eileen's requested prayer for Regan. At least the two polyps they found both turned out to be benign. So there's a good chance that the third one they want to do surgery on may be benign as well. But continue to make that a matter of prayer. We've got another appointment in December. We won't know anything until then, but we may unfortunately be looking at a knee surgery. So not looking forward to that. If we have to do that, there may be some other options, but we haven't found them yet. So pray about that if you would. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship, and let's continue on here now. Let's look at, as we review this, every 3 or 4 years, I think is sufficient for reviewing doctrines, but sometimes we don't get to them till 5, 6, 7 years, but particularly ones that are critical. Of all the doctrines, we can categorize them to some extent. Some doctrines are critical and more important to the Christian life than other doctrines are. Understanding eschatology is helpful. It's a blessing, but doesn't necessarily help you live the Christian life. Well, the doctrine of love, doctrine of authority, the ministry of the Spirit, and these other things. Well, obviously, the doctrine of the local church. These are things that are much more germane to our day-to-day existence that we have to deal with. So here, introduction. While love is a complex concept that resists any sort of simple definition, it is perhaps the most celebrated subject in human history. People have a lot to say about it. Now, they may not know what they're saying. It may not make any sense to anybody but them, but they have a lot to say about it. And again, very views of love are very skewed for a bunch of reasons. Not the least of which, of course, is the matter of the indwelling sin nature, which skews all truth along the lines of its own tendencies and trends. Well, B, since it is so meaningful, many have an opinion as to the nature of love and its significance. However, many conceptions of love proceed from the human viewpoint and do not reflect God's view on the matter. This is another issue, of course, is that when it comes to the matter of love, we have to accept God's definition, not what people think. And people all have their own ideas, and that's all fine. We understand everybody's got an opinion, and you have the right to your opinion. But if it does not reflect what God says about it, then your opinion's wrong. I hate to break it to you. We're going to go with God over what some human might say. See, love is something that is common to both God and man, existing as an attribute of God. 1 John 4:8 simply says God is love. Not that he has love or that he loves, but that he himself is love. And that this is one of the 10 divine attributes. And of course, because of this, we recognize that this permeates God. That's all due to all the other attributes. And because of immutability applied, if God's ever been loving, he's always loving. He can't be any other way. And again, but it's knowing what love is. And most people tend to view love in terms of the way they feel about something. That's just what seems to be what permeates the human race is what they love. But they certainly show it, you know. What they love. As I was sitting there yesterday watching Wisconsin play Minnesota in a blinding snowstorm, and I thought of all the 100,000 people sitting there, and I thought, if it snowed in Bible class, I'd probably not have anybody show up. Of course, it can't snow in here, thank God. But they're sitting there on them metal benches, you know, freezing their butts off. But this is important to them. This is what they love. And they'll make any sacrifice to get there. You know, 2 hours to ride to the game, 4 hours of tailgating, 4 hours for the football game, 30 or 40 minutes for the fist fights afterwards, and, you know, and then on home. Well, that's a big day, you know, $80 for parking, $150 for tickets, however much it costs. I don't know, I'm just picking figures now. But it's not cheap. And they'll run their whole life around that day, Saturdays. We try to tell people to run your life around Sundays. No, that's too much trouble. Well, it's not for them. Well, also Genesis 25, 28. This is just a verse simply that indicates that people have manifested and expressed love. Now, Isaac loved Esau. It's not a commentary on anything, just a bare statement. Unfortunately, Isaac did what a father shouldn't do. He played favorites. And that's not what any parent should do. You have to treat the kids the same. But Isaac was he liked Esau. Esau was more of a man's man. He was a hunter, outdoor guy, you know, did all those things that Isaac respected and looked up to in some ways. And Jacob was not that way. Jacob, learned how to cook, probably did some needlepoint. And he was maybe not, maybe that, but I'm exaggerating a little bit. But he was more of a mama's boy, frankly. And you see this division in the family. But just to point out here that Isaac did love Esau, that existed. But Rebecca loved Jacob. See, they were both playing favorites. Bad news. Doesn't work out very well for the kids in that environment. However, failure to understand the various forms of love and the biblical parameters of love has led to a great deal of misplaced emotion. Many erroneous interpretations of the Bible, many false conclusions, and some serious misapplications that actually all lead to error, unfortunately. So therefore, the goal of this doctrine is to accurately define the various forms of love, how they relate to one another, and to set forth the biblical views on this matter. Hebrew vocabulary here, a verb, have actually 218 times. That's actually mistranslated there. That should be A-H-A-B-H, have instead of have there. To desire, literally, to pant after, to long for, to love. It's used of God only in a good sense. Used of men in both good ways and bad ways. And one of the things is we know with faith, the merit of faith does not lie in the faith itself. It lies in the object of the faith. Well, the same way is true of love. The object can be wrong. If you love the wrong things, you're headed for trouble. But the object can be correct. So there are legitimate and non-legitimate objects of love. Here, ahava. A noun, 34 times, generally translated of love, again used of both God and men. Dode, 61 times, love, lover, or beloved. It's a noun, used of an object of love, a loved one, and it's even used, of course, of relatives because they're supposed to be your loved ones. Kashak, a verb, 11 times, to be attached, literally, to be joined together. To adhere, to cling, or to be devoted to someone. And sometimes that word's just translated as loved, but it's certainly an expression of it. Agav, a verb, 7 times, to have inordinate affection for, to lust after. It's used, for instance, of love for idolatry. And people love various things, as we're going to see. Why? Can we say this? Well, people say, well, you don't know what they love. You can't read their minds. Wrong. Gong. I can tell you what they love by their lifestyle. It's absolute. You don't have to judge mental attitudes to know what people's priorities are. You just look at the overt. And they'll tell you what the priorities are. You just have to watch. Be discerning. Don't be a schmuck. When you see it, admit it. What you're seeing. No, they've manifested their priorities aren't really right here. Okay, that's not judging. That's just an observation. We, as Jesus did, discourage and criticize sinful judging. Don't judge. Don't judge people's mental attitudes. You don't know. You can't know. But what we can know is their lifestyle. And when the person spent 12, 14 hours yesterday sitting through a snowstorm to watch a football game, and today can't get out of bed, go anywhere, have nothing to do with God, that tells me what their priorities are. And it's evident. And I don't have to judge what they're thinking. I can just judge their actions. And not in a sinful way, just evaluate. Using the word there, evaluate is a better term than judge. Judge has some bad connotations sometimes. So Ezekiel 23, she used three times there, 5, 7, and 9, all in that same chapter. Oholah played the harlot while she was mine. And she lusted after her lovers, after the Assyrians, her neighbors. Here, idol worship in terms of loving, putting first these other nations that were supposed to provide protection. That's the idea. They were to provide the protection they wanted that God wasn't providing for them. Well, why wasn't God providing protection for them? And rather than figure that out and get their act together, well, they substitute something else. They look for another answer. 7, she bestowed her harlotries on all of them, all of whom were the choicest men of Assyria. And with all whom she lusted after, with all their idols, she defiled herself. And therefore I will give her into the hands of her lovers, into the hands of the Assyrians, after whom she lusted. They look to these nations to provide again what God wasn't, because of their attitudes and their actions, their refusal to love God. They came under judgment. And so then they look to these people to deliver them and to be what God was supposed to be for them. Well, that upsets God. God's a jealous God. He doesn't care for that. He doesn't want us bestowing our love, all of that on other things other than Him. He wants it all. And obviously we don't always do it perfectly, but still you understand. Well, be here the Greek vocabulary, agapao, the verb 147 times, to love. Used primarily of God's love. However, one must be quite careful to understand the meaning in the context in which it is used, and not force a single meaning into each context. The term is not strictly technical. And what we talk about with a technical term is a term that means the same thing in every context. You have two types of terms in the structure, and that is terms that are non-technical, and they can mean different things in different contexts depending upon how they're used, or terms that are technical, and that is they mean the same thing in every context. And so if it's technical, then we could say, because see, many people have defined agapao as love, as God's love as opposed to man's love. Agape, the noun is what they would be referring to. They would say agape is God's love. Phileo is man's love. Wrong. They're both applied to God. So you can't say that. And they're both applied to men. So that definition falls short, far short of what we can say about these terms and can't say about it. To say that agape is God's love and not man's love, that's wrong. Man can execute agape. And that's the second cognate there, or the first cognate rather, agape, noun, 116 times. It means love. It's always translated as love. This does not focus on the emotional aspects of love as much as it focuses on love as a personal decision. See, one of the differences between these words, and we will point this out, is that agape is a choice. Well, all love is a choice. You're not forced to love anybody. You have to choose it. You have to want to. But again, to know how to love and how to apply in a given situation, that can take many manifestations. Whatever the situation might call for. And that will vary from place to place, time to time. Be agapetos, adjective 61 times. That means loved one or beloved. Most of the time this is translated as beloved. And again, the E-T-O-S ending there has the form of a passive. The idea of it's one who is loved or being loved. It has the form, the ending there of a passive. So being loved or loved one. Phileo, a verb 25 times. Well, first the thing you can look at, you could say, phileo is only used about 1/6 of the amount of time agape is, or agapao, the verb. So it's not used as much. That's the first observation you could make, that the emphasis is more on agape in that family of words than it is on these. This means to love, to have affection for something or someone. Philia, a feminine noun, is only used one time. It means friendship or affection. Philos, A masculine noun there is used 29 times. It means a friend or a familiar companion. And most of the time you'll see these terms, they'll be translated in terms of what of the English words friendship. Friend or friendship and that sort of thing. Because we understand what that is. Most people understand the difference between, say, a friend. You should understand that there's a difference between a lot of things. You got your physical family here. You got your spiritual family. Well, those are different. They're not all the same. Then you've got what we would call friends. You got even closer things. People you love, like your wife, husband and wife, and all that. The closest and most intimate of earthly relationships. That should be characterized by love. Then you have love for your extended family. Well, that's not the same love you have for your wife exactly. Better not be. Put an end to that right now. We're not in Kentucky, for God's sake. You know. Then you have love for your extended family. Then you have acquaintances, people you know at work that you deal with all the time. Maybe you go to the same bank every day and you deal with them, or the same grocery store and you know the people and all that. Well, those are acquaintances. But everyone, no matter which group it is, we're commanded to love them. But the love isn't the same, obviously. And it certainly isn't manifested in exactly the same way. So that's part of what we'll deal with in all of this, is the manifestation of love. But very often this has the idea of friendship. And certainly friendship is a form of love. I love my friends. I don't love them in the same way I love my wife. But I love them. I have an emotional attachment to them. I don't want anything bad happening to them. I want the best for them. But Philos, again, focuses more on this idea of affection or friendship. How you feel, and that's what we'll point out, it's how you feel about the person. Philos is also joined with numerous other nouns to form compounds that are used to denote love or affection for something. 2 Timothy, for instance, it's used there, 2 Timothy 3:4. Probably in a bad context here. Actually here, used twice. Philos is joined with hedone or hedonos. We get our word hedonism from that. Lovers of pleasure, lovers of hedonism. And there's still whole societies devoted to hedonism. You can go online, I wouldn't recommend it, but you can. There are lots of people devoted to this as a way of life. That the highest good is pleasure. And that's not unusual. That permeated some of the Greek philosophies way back when. It's not new news. There's nothing really new under the sun. And I think Solomon, to some extent, of course, was ridiculing some of these ideas in the book of Ecclesiastes. Because everything isn't always pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. As we know. So here it says, lovers of pleasure rather than philotheos, lovers of God. There are the two compounds. Also, 3 John 9. I wrote something to the church. But Diotrephes, who loves to be first. This is a philo protuo. And it comes from protos, to be first. This is one of the things many doctrinal pastors have fallen into, this love of being first. I've got all the authority. You can't question me. I'm always right. God, I wish I thought that way. No, I don't. I'm glad I don't think that way. Because that is incorrect. Nobody has it. But again, much of this goes back to a failure to understand spiritual gifts. If you've got the gift, you're definitely better than everybody else. You know that. And you just have a gift. And you got to say it with the right inflection to get it across. I'm up here. You're down here. But that isn't the way it is. We're all in Christ. We're all one. We're all uniform. We're all equal. Doesn't mean that I don't have authority or something. That doesn't mitigate change authority structures. But it does mean that, first, I'm not unique or different in any weird way. Well, maybe weird ways, but spiritually, anyway, is what I'm talking about. But Diotrephes, he'd be the kind of guy that sits up there in a gold chair and a throne and says, come on, serve me. Is that what the pastor's supposed to be doing? No. No, that's not what the pastor's supposed to be doing. We'll deal with all that. Well, lexicographers and theologians have debated for years. Oh, and the debate's ongoing, by the way. This isn't solved, according to most of them. They're not quite sure. I mean, most of them have some feel for it, but they're still debating this and arguing it at some level. The exact relationship between these two families of Greek words. And then four, while there is some consensus among them, the following observations have been advanced in order to shed some light on the similarities and the differences between the words. A, many have recognized the distinction between the two families is not the distinction between God's love and man's love. Some of them have figured that part out. They've gone away from, that was the most simplistic, I think, explanation of the terms. Agape is God's love, philia is man's love. It's not. Because they're both applied to God and they're both applied to man. So you can't say that. Is agape applied more to God than to men? Yes. Is philos applied more to men than God? Yes. But if they're both applied, then there has to be some overlap at least that you have to consider. That they can't be just complete antonyms or complete synonyms. So it's not a distinction between a higher form of love and a lower form of love. In that thinking, agape would be the higher form of love, and philos in some way is a secondary or subordinate form of love that's not as good. It's not as much love as agape is, would be their thinking on that. But it is, as we'll see. Or a distinction between genuine love and pseudo-love. Well, agape always means real love, and this other can be pseudo-love. Well, when he says lover who loves to be first, that's not pseudo-love. He literally wants to be number one. It's a real love for being in charge. Approbation lust, power lust, you're going to serve me, and this is the way it goes. Well, that's not what they're supposed to be doing. And in fact, John countered all this. He didn't ever come out and say what this believer should do. But he basically says, he points out that Demetrius in verse 12 has a good testimony. And so Diotrephes and the group he was leading, the implication here, I think, is get away from him. Get away from Diotrephes. If you see this in people, run. This is not Christianity. This is not biblical Christianity. Look for Demetrius. He has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. And we add our testimony. So my thinking as I've read this and looked at it over the years is that Demetrius is also a teacher of the truth. And Diotrephes may have been at one time, but he lost his way. Well, we don't know what he was or wasn't, but presuming he didn't get into the position by accident or assume it. But it was there legitimately and then went a little bit haywire. And that can happen. Again, that's why even in the Old Testament, under the Mosaic Law. And still, even in the New Testament, there's provision made for divorce. We don't advocate it, but there's provision made for it if you can't do anything else. If you just are at a complete standstill and your Christian life is going nowhere and you're in danger of killing each other, you probably need a divorce. But we don't encourage it because there's only two legitimate biblical reasons for divorce, death and, of course, adultery. So, and the same thing's true here. I wouldn't encourage somebody to go look for somebody else. But if this guy's lost his mind and now thinks that he's king or God, even worse, then get away from him. And I think that's what John implies in so many words without coming out and just explicitly saying, you have other options. He implies that there's another option here. So again, it's not between, again, a distinction there between genuine love and pseudo-love. So in some cases, both terms are used in parallel passages, which on the surface suggest a considerable overlapping of meaning between the two families. So there is some overlap. For instance, Matthew 23:6, if we look at there. They love the place of honor at banquets and the best seats in the synagogues. This is a reference to the religious leaders, of course, who are maladjusted and, man, show their maladjustment by their public displays of how important they are. You know, they walk into the room, they expect everybody to drop what they're doing. They just figure if there's a chief seat, it's for them. I just assume that you want me to have the best because I am the best. That's their mentality. They love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogue. And here the verb is phileo, indicating that they have an affection for this stuff. But Luke 11:43, which I believe is the direct parallel. Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the chief seats in the synagogues and the respectful greetings in the marketplaces. Well, here he uses agape to express their love for this. So both words are used of human. First, both words are here used of maladjusted humans too. That this love, whatever love that is they're manifesting, is some kind of maladjusted love. It's not what God wants, certainly. However, many have correctly noted that the agapao family of words is used in commands to love, while the phileo family is never commanded in the Bible. So that's a big distinction that you have to make. If this term is used, the verb especially, is used in commands, love, and the other one never is, then whatever type of love we're looking at here must be a choice, must be something you can do, must be a choice you make. Whereas the phileo family of words, it's not commanded. So you're not commanded to feel a certain way about things. Other than the extent where you find these, you know, legitimate commands. But those are very often commands to how to treat one another, how to interact with one another, how to interact with God and all that. It's not telling you how to feel as much as most commands are telling you what to do. And so this has to be a doing command. If you're commanded to love, again, then that word is, that's important. So again, although there may be point D here, some overlapping of meaning, it also suggests there is some distinction to be made between the two families. And here's where, obviously, as you go into this, it's easy just to be superficial and say, well, this word, this family of words means this, this family means this, and there's never any overlap. Well, there is overlap, though, at some level. And that would be too superficial and it'd be wrong. So in that regard, when there is a distinction to be made between the words, it is that the agapao family of words focuses on love as a choice one makes, when the emphasis is on the object of love or the interests of the object of love. Luke chapter 7, verse 5. So another thing about commands is also that if a person is commanded to love, certainly in the biblical commands, in the Bible, we're talking about. If he's commanded to love, that implies, and in fact we know it's true, that implies that you have the ability to do so. That this can be done, that this is not an impossibility. God doesn't issue imperatives again and then keep us from doing them. That's not why we have the royal imperatives. The royal imperatives are set the tone and the tenor and the structure for your life. But you obviously can do them or they're useless. And again, the dynamic of fulfilling the imperatives isn't found in just memorizing them and doing them as you would like the law. It's found in this internal dynamic of spiritual growth that works. Well, Luke 7:5 here, for he loves our nation. And there it uses agapao. So how do we know he loved the nation? He built the synagogue. That's how they're giving him an example of this guy's love by what he has done, by his overt actions. And so when it says he loves our nation, it's not saying he has a warm feeling in his heart for Israel. It's saying that he practically expressed love by giving them what they needed, by fulfilling a need. And that need in their case was building a synagogue. They apparently did not have the wherewithal to do it. And he took it upon himself. So F, when the phileo family is used, it denotes the type of affection that proceeds from the emotions and the feelings, and is generally used of the close personal relationships. And short, while one cannot always eliminate emotion, see this, and people have tried to eliminate the idea of emotion from agapao and phileo. Phileo focuses more on the emotional aspect of it, but that's not to say there's never an emotional construct or aspect to biblical love, to agape love. Now, you can feel a certain way about it. To say love is a synonym for filling of the Spirit. That's nonsense. Love is an emotion at best, or it's a choice. It's not a state, as it were. And so this, and I've seen this taken, and people, you know, they say, well, if you're walking in the ministry of the Spirit, you will exhibit this love. You may or may not. You should. The fruit of the Spirit's love, peace, joy. You should. But I mean, what happens when you get out of fellowship? Are you still going to manifest love? No, probably not. Or if you do, it may be misguided or whatever, tainted by whatever it is you think you're supposed to be doing. I don't know. So you can't eliminate this idea of emotion. This is another whole thing. There is a certain emotion that should permeate. And when we talk about esprit de corps, we talk about the common spirit and emotion that should pervade a body, that that puts the body first. And again, used in the military, but should be a very regular function of the church. That there should be a unity, a unanimity that proceeds from the doctrine we know and that we want to apply and that we all are growing in the same direction. That's what that's about. Well, so one cannot always eliminate emotion from the discussion of love. The agapao family focuses more on the ethics of love, while the phileo family deals more with the emotions of love, how you feel about it. And so this is where people get very confused. For instance, when they're commanded to love their enemies, many people think God's telling me I've got to have a warm fuzzy in my heart for my enemies. That's not what he's saying at all. And very often, when these things are found, particularly the agape family of words, they're defined by context. What's he talking about when he's talking about love? What does he mean by love, even? And very often the context, I think if you look ahead, we're in chapter 3. So chapter 4, Ephesians 4. I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. Again, the implication is the calling is high, the standard should be high. The calling comes from God himself. How can you get a higher call than that? I don't think you can. With all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love. Well, there, the idea of love is certainly manifested with the idea of being tolerant and patient with one another. That's a part of what love is. Now, it doesn't say, I want you to feel thus and such way about everybody. But he says, I want you to act thus and such way towards other people. And that is the manifestation, or certainly part of it in this case, of what love is. So three, definition and description. A, the Greek term eros. And I didn't put that in the vocabulary because it's not used in the Greek New Testament. Relates to the passionate aspect of love between a man that should be a man and a woman. Between a man and a woman. One, the term, that family in fact, is not used in the Bible. But the reality of passion and yearning is mentioned in a number of places in both the Old and New Testament. We just mentioned a Song of Solomon. It's all about sort of the sexual, passionate aspects of love. It's not totally about that, but that permeates kind of the book. It might be a fun one to do sometime, see if we can freak everybody out. You know, as he's writing about her breasts and her neck and various aspects of her physique. And, can't teach that. And of course, that book has been mangled because many of them don't want to deal with it in context, and they want to make it a metaphor. And I'm not saying that there aren't analogies in the book and metaphors; there are, but they want to make it something like Pilgrim's Progress or something that this really applies. This is between Christ and the church, and so he writes about sex. Well, I don't think Christ is having sex with the church, but the fact is. Obviously, it does show very close, intimate relationships. That's what the whole book's about. I mean, if you read it, you might be freaked. If you haven't ever read it, you might want to read it. But it certainly deals with passion. There's no question. And 1 Thessalonians, also 4:5 in the New Testament. Here he talks about it kind of in a negative way here, and not in lustful passion. The question becomes here is what he's got, how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and in honor. The question is here, is the vessel his own body or is it his wife that they're asking, or the marital partner? Which one is in view here? And I haven't done this one. I'd have to go back and look. I did this book very early on, though, but I haven't looked at it in probably 30 years, so I'd have to go back and see what I even said. But the emphasis here in verse 5 is not in lustful passion, like the Gentiles who do not know God. The matter of sex lust beyond propriety, that's what the Gentiles are into. I mean, you don't have to go far on the internet to find that out. Improper views of sex and passion and all of that. The porn industry is billions and billions and billions of dollars a year. But that's not the kind of love we're looking for. So sexual love, point two here, was designed by God for the mutual benefit of the husband and the wife. And we shouldn't have to say this, but we will. It's for a male and a female in the bonds of monogamous relationship and marriage. A single man, single woman, in marriage. A heterosexual relationship, by the way. We shouldn't have to say that either, but we will. And is to be enjoyed only in the context of a faithful and monogamous marriage. There's no place for sex outside of marriage, frankly. Now, the cosmos smiles at this. They laugh at it. Every other TV show in the world portrays immorality as a regular feature of life. They don't think anything of it. People getting pregnant out of wedlock. I watch Modern Family. The little girl gets pregnant out of wedlock. Oh, this is all fine. We're going to keep you in the basement and take care of you. Idiots. This is a shame. You ought to be ashamed. But see, our culture knows no shame anymore. They know no embarrassment. The things they ought to be ashamed of, they glory in their shame. They think this is a badge of honor or something. Well, see how open-minded we are? No, you're stupid. There's a huge difference between being open-minded and stupid. And when it comes to the Bible, they are flat out stupid. And we know that. They can't really do anything else. So, be nice we could pray and save, but we can't. 1 Corinthians 7:2. And he talks about that apparently the Corinthians had asked some matters about this. Matters of marriage and all of that. And what the rules were. And Jesus' teaching on this was pretty strict. And some have suggested here, in Corinthians, they call this passage the Pauline privilege. And they suggest that Paul allows for separation but not divorce. Number one, that's not what he teaches. That interpretation is wrong. He does not allow for separation and not divorce. He's talking about marriage and divorce, and he says don't do it. One, don't get married if you can help it. That's how he looked at it. He said, I wish everybody was like me. I could handle not being married. It's no big deal. But most people can't. Most people are going to be married in their lives. That's just the way life works. For most people, for the vast majority of the human race. So they ask him about some certain things. We don't know specifically what they ask about. But he said it is good for a man not to touch a woman. He is not encouraging sexual relationships here. But because of immoralities. And the fact is, people don't have the ability to control themselves sexually. Some people are worse at it than others. They have whole groups for this, whatever it is, something anonymous, sexaholics, whatever they are. They have whole groups, like AA, now they got a group for everything. And the reality is some people, this is a very big area of weakness in their sin nature. Most teenage boys have this weakness. The fact is, it gets worse. After puberty, this gets worse because then you're more interested in girls at some point. Not immediately necessarily, but you will be. So, but there's immorality, and this is sex outside of any kind of legitimate reason for sex. This is inappropriate sex. Sex outside the confines of marriage. So, because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife. First, you're to get married. That's the first thing. And each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill the duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. Well, three, it has the benefit of providing recreation, its primary purpose. But it ensures the propagation of the human race. That's the whole be fruitful and multiply thing. And Adam and Eve certainly enjoyed Under perfection, again, untested holiness, we would say. They really hadn't been exposed to evil at any level at this time. And their relationship was characterized in chapter 2, 22 through 25, by this open and honest relationship that had no problems in that regard. The God fashioned the woman into a woman, the rib which he had taken from the man. Some of you probably got that picture, Adam and Eve's baby pictures. And the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother." That's the first thing about marriage. You have to break off the relationship with the family. You're not to get married and live with mommy and daddy. That's not God's will. You're to separate from these people at a certain level. And for this reason, and there may be other reasons in the scripture, I haven't found anything explicitly yet to just tell you the truth. But for this reason means for marriage. And the idea of a sexual relationship, this is the reason to leave home when you establish a new family, a new unit. And until that, I advise most people to stay at home, stay under the authority God's provided, and you can live your Christian life out just fine. Now, if God provides you for a marital relationship, fine. Obviously, in the ideal, you don't want anybody who's not positive to doctrine. That's the ideal. You don't want somebody who's negative. They're not going to be there to support you. You're not going to have there's a certain relationship you just will not have with a negative person. Spiritually, you can't. Because they're not looking at it from God's perspective, and you're trying to. So that relationship at a certain level is always going to be frustrated if you marry somebody that's negative. There'll always be an issue there. And that's why we never encourage people to marry negative people. Certainly not unbelievers. The Bible's very clean on that. The Bible is very clear. You don't marry an unbeliever. So, but for this reason, a man shall leave his father. For what reason? Marriage. And until then, I encourage people to stay under their authorities. Now, it doesn't mean there's never another time. I haven't found any big reasons in the scripture other than marriage for this. But that doesn't mean it's not appropriate. So, and he will be joined to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked. And actually, you've got a hithpael here. They did nothing to shame themselves or shame each other. The concept of shame was not even existent. They were in a complete, absolute harmony at every level. And that's what marriage is supposed to be in the ideal. Now, we live in a fallen world. Are two people ever going to be in absolute harmony? Only if one of them is brain dead. That's the only way it's going to, or both of them could be brain dead. But other than that, you're going to have conflicts because you've got sin natures. And I know what everybody thinks when they want to get married. I've watched people go through this time and time and time again. And, I love this person. They're everything. They're everything for me. I don't need anything else. This is it. This is just wonderful. God has set this up and it's all wonderful. Nothing will ever go wrong. And 5 months later, 6 months later, here we go. You find out, oh my God, they have a sin nature. They don't want me to always have my way when you're dating. You know, when you're dating, you're at least supposed to be on your best behavior. You're trying to impress the person, right? Supposedly. And if your dating thing is characterized by rockiness and all that, there's probably something wrong. Because that's when you're supposed to be on your best. I mean, you're really trying to win the person over. You share the popcorn. You know. You turn down the bed for them. You open the car door. You do all this stuff. Well, that kind of begins to fade, doesn't it? Well, my husband's no longer as wonderful as he used to be. Oh, but you are. Well, we all have our problems. We all have to grow through them, and I get all that. But here, they had no shame. This was a perfect relationship. And this is what the ideal idea of marriage is. Two people that are on the same page at every point. That makes it sure. That sure eliminates a lot of need for conflict. And having doctrine at the focal point, at the center of all of this, is the thing that ties it all together and makes it work. And can you have a successful marriage apart from doctrine? Somewhat, sure. There are people who have been married for a long, long time. They were happy, I guess, more or less. And But when you go back, if you start really interviewing them, I watch some of these shows, and I'd be sitting there, and they say, "Oh, Grandma, Grandpa, you and Grandma were married all those years. You really love Grandma." And he just goes, "Grandma." But maybe he wasn't loving her as much as she thought, or as everybody else thought. And but anyway, that's that. And then 1:27 and 28 is the establishment principle of it, where God establishes this to be fruitful and multiply, and to fill the earth and subdue it. Again, this is one of the reasons why I would suggest to you that if he was a normal female and had a normal cycle and all that, and God told them to multiply, they weren't in the garden very long. She would have gotten pregnant. So that's why I suggest they probably weren't in the garden all that long. People have suggested decades or centuries. I don't think so. Now, and again, this would say God gave them a command and then prohibited them from applying it. I don't see that as God. So the fact that there is no term for sexual love in the New Testament highlights the reality that sex does not constitute love in any true biblical sense of the word. When people talk about sex, that's not the same as love. They're not synonyms. Love between a husband and a wife, point five, requires the application of both partners toward one another. This should be the result of mutual choices to share love and emotional intimacy, which indicates agape and philia are already present. The two forms of love, the two biblical terms of love, are present. Six, since love, this form of love is quite pleasurable. You may not know this, but some people find sex fun. So they've abused this provision, as you might imagine, because it is pleasurable. I was watching it, the new one, young Sheldon, the other day, and his mom ends up putting on this house as a Halloween deal to scare people into getting saved. We're going to do that next year. I thought it was a good idea, it's fundamentalists from Texas here. But at any rate, they were there, and now I forgot my point. She was showing them how unpleasurable sex was. And that that love led to all, sex leads to all manner of things. And they just tried to scare people away from it. Well, guess what? Scaring people away from sex doesn't work. Because they'll find out you're lying eventually. And once they find out you're lying, well, then they're going to question everything you told them. Once you've done that. So many have abused this provision by engaging in normal forms of perversion, such as fornication and adultery. They're still perversion, but at least they're normal, man and a woman. Having sex. It's not God's will. They're not married, but at least you can understand that's normal. Others have abused the normal arrangement of God by engaging in abnormal perversions, such as homosexuality, lesbianism, bestiality, etc. None of those are promoted by the Bible. In fact, they're all condemned. And some might argue, the Mosaic Law has been set aside, so all those things about homosexuals are no longer valid. That's not true. The Bible speaks to this stuff. The New Testament speaks to it. It says to avoid all that. Now, we don't have a mandate to kill anybody. Whereas under the civil code of Israel, if you were caught in these types of activities, these were viewed as civil crimes that were punished with death. Capital crimes, in fact, that were punished with death. And so that's how strongly God feels about it. But again, we've got it's a lengthy one, an apologetic against homosexuality on file. I'm not going to review it here. But the fact is, all this that you've been taught, some of maybe if you've been taught that the Greeks were, they were more into male-male relationships and they promoted all of this. The fact is, while that existed within the Greek culture, their more enlightened thinkers condemned it, just like the Bible condemned it. And they pointed out that this is a perversion, this is gross, this is wrong. And the people who were engaged in this kind of stuff were not good for society. That was the enlightened Greek view of this. So this idea that, this has just been a part of culture and it's a part of Hellenism, that you should have these consensual male relationships. Nothing in the Bible about it, certainly. And again, even in Greek culture, when you compare their thinking to some of the things that have been promoted, you find out, it doesn't hold water. And I tried to, and everything I cited in there, if I remember right, I tried to document everything. There should be footnotes all over the place in that thing of where this stuff comes from. All right, well, our time is just about up here. We're going to stop there because this next point is going to take more than a minute. So we'll let it there and pick up here Tuesday night. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that this matter of love would find a fertile soil in our heart and do what it is meant to do in our Christian lives, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.